surfacing some of the things that some friends and I in Chicago have been talking about, working through, about the notion of service the last few years. It's a topic that I would really only want to surface among friends, because it's a topic that critiques what most of us who work together to try to alleviate a little bit of human suffering, whether in secular or church settings, hold in common. It really doesn't deal as a topic with the kinds of movements, more or less at the edge of the of the church, that Walt has been talking about this week. Rather, I want to look a little bit at some of the central kinds of matters of unexamined faith and activity that lie, for many of us, at the core of what our religion means, at least as we begin to translate it into what we do in the world. I come at these kinds of questions not from the perspective of a theologian, which I ain't, but from the perspective of somebody who tries to look at what's going on in the society, and particularly in cities, and figure out what that has to say to the church, without necessarily resorting to theological categories in which I am out of my depth to make sense of them. So, for those of you who are at home in theological categories, you will have to do whatever the translation is necessary from the questions that I want to deal with for a bit this morning. Bear with me. I want to set the picture that I draw this morning in secular language first, and look a little bit at some of what I think are the radically new kinds of contexts in which we work, live, think, try to serve, and love. It seems to me that one of the still unrecognized major drifts in our society over the last 15 or 20 years is the drift toward what we might call a client society. In the past 30 years, we've been changing from a society whose economy is based on the production of goods to a society whose workforce is largely in the provision of services. This trend toward a service economy, by most estimates, will continue. Daniel Bell estimates that in 10 years, 20% of the labor force will be at work producing things. 20% will produce all of the things that we need in the society to sustain life. And 80% of us, therefore, will be engaged in the production of services. Bell estimates further that by the year 2000, 3% of us will be all that's necessary to produce all of the goods the society needs to live on. What if the rest of us? In traditional economic terms, those of us who do not produce goods are, at least to some degree, useless. The production of services, which I suspect almost everybody in the room is engaged in, I'm not sure that any of us in the room produce any goods that are necessary for the society. The production of services has some parallels with the production of goods. Just as producers need consumers, hence advertising, so producers of services need clients. The creation of clients has become an economic necessity. Almost any condition that human beings can possibly have, when it's defined as a problem, becomes a condition in need of a service or a solution. You create clients by giving the human condition a name, preferably in Latin. You call the human condition a deficiency, or better yet, a disease. You mystify the person having the deficiency by developing a language which he cannot understand, and you convince him that your skill will solve his problem. A couple of examples. There may have been a time when poor people were people without money. But in the past decade, they have been seen to have a wide range of deficiencies. They have weak ego strength. They have pre-conventional morality. They have a limited time horizon. They have an inability to defer immediate gratification. And they had reading disabilities. They had problems relating to authority. They had ambivalent attitudes toward property. They had a propensity toward crime. And the list goes on and on and on. Read Edward Banfield if you need a further list. So when the federal government supposedly wanted to do something about poverty in urban America, first in the poverty program and then in model cities and the plethora of programs we still have today, what did the feds do? Did they give the poor money? No. They gave them helpers. They gave the poor teachers, teacher aides, health workers, police aides, mental health workers, psychiatric social workers, employment counselors, recreation supervisors, land use planners, counselors, group workers, caseworkers, therapists, etc., etc., etc. We said to the poor, something is wrong with you and you need help. Did all of this money poured into poverty help the poor? Not particularly. But it did help another group of people. Obviously, the new employees of the growing helping bureaucracies. Might include some of us in this room. Another example. Take medicine, for instance. A lot of my thinking in this area is influenced, as some of you I'm sure already aware, by some of the work done by Ivan Illich, sometimes located in Cuernavaca, but making forays into the United States to see what life for much of the world might be like if it goes the way that lots of people think it might. Illich has a 1976 book called Medical Nemesis, in which he takes on the medical system in advanced Western societies. Illich argues that the nature of scientific medicine these days is specifically counterproductive. Central to his argument is the notion of iatrogenic illness. This refers to the illness we get by coming into contact with the medical system. He is not talking simply here about the risks of illness of clienthood when we are stripped of the powers to heal ourselves. He writes in Medical Nemesis, a professional and physician-based healthcare system that has grown beyond critical bounds is sickening for three reasons. It is sickening because it must produce clinical damage that outweighs its potential benefits, otherwise it ceases to grow. It cannot but obscure the political conditions that render society unhealthy, and it tends to mystify and to expropriate the power of the individual to heal himself and to shape his or her environment. The same notion obviously could apply to other areas. Many of our social problems may be caused or at least aggravated by those institutions which are charged with the task of solving the problem. One can immediately think of how slum clearance in the 1950s became instant slum creation, or how the welfare system serves to sustain the debilitating welfare cycle. You can think of other examples of how treatment by experts creates illness. The solutions fail, but the failure is always blamed not on the expert, but on the client. The client is increasingly powerless to discover and act on the real source of the problem. This overexpansion of helping agencies or problem-solving agencies leads to disabling dependency and weakens the communal coping ability that we were talking about last night in the forum, the communal coping ability of groups that are supposed to be served. In a service economy, you must find or create clients by discovering or creating needs for services. There's a new profession growing in urban America called bereavement counseling. It used to be that people who were sad, who had lost a loved one, might want to turn to a friend or a member of the family, or simply grieve in private. No longer. We now have the benefit of carefully trained, advanced degree-holding bereavement counselors. They will know in 15 steps how to take us through the human process of grieving. Wonderful. We have an absolutely inexhaustible supply of needs. They wait only the creation. The problem is obvious. That as each new need is created, citizens have an increased sense of deficiency and dependence. This is the irony of helping as we have institutionalized it. It weakens the capacity of the help. John McKnight of Northwestern University Center for Urban Affairs, in a forthcoming book, The Serviced Society, refers to the therapeutic ideology. It's a simple threefold ideology. Number one, the basic problem is you. The resolution of your problem is my professional control of you. And my control is your help. You will be better because I know better. Your welfare is outside of yourself. You become the consumer of institutional service. Their capacity makes for your incapacity. Their power for your impotence. Our clientage, and we are all in some sense as clients as well as servers, becomes the basis for our unity. But as a unity of dependent people, not interdependent, but dependent people, it is increasingly not a unity, but a uniformity. The definition of our clientage and of the service performed lies outside ourselves. In a client society, there are no citizens. To be a citizen means to have power. To be a client is to have power taken away. What of the church in this kind of a client or serviced society? What of the servant church? Can we spend a couple of minutes trying to unpack some of the language we use in the church? And I'm talking again about the best of the church, that part of the church that I love and relate to and am part of. The kind of language we use in the church to justify the creation of dependency and powerlessness and incapacity. I think we need to look very closely at the meaning and practice of some of our most cherished notions. Service in the context of the church generates caring institutions and groups, caring people. Service translates to caring. Caring institutions and groups and people base their caring activity on love. Who could be against love? I'm wondering if we might not consider being against love. Maybe we ought to be. At least when love equals caring, equals service, equals client creation, it ought to raise some questions for us. For what caring service really becomes is a substitute for justice. In the larger society, the provision of services acts as a safety valve for discontent. those who conceive of themselves as bundles of needs have great difficulty seeing themselves as active citizens, self-generating seekers after justice. And those who provide services to those bundles of needs are blinded to the root causes of misery. In the church, the provision of services based on the definition of needs as belonging only to individuals might be the ultimate opiate. The bargain is struck. I love you as Christ has commanded. I see you as needing what I have. I give you what you need. If you are properly grateful, that is, if you join the church or proclaim your conversion, or even just say a simple thank you, I've got you. You are hooked on my help. And I am hooked on being needed. We have set up not a human relationship, but simply another market relationship in the area of the service economy. And I, as the provider of services, control that market relationship. Helping becomes for me a daily necessary fix. I need it like an addict, as totally as you need me. We are both totally hooked. Our love for each other is hardly that, for it's based totally on dependency. It is vividly and strongly conditional, predicated on the assumption that free, open, honest, struggling, challenging interchange between human beings who are ends in themselves will never intrude upon our market relationship and will never threaten our mutual addiction. Is there an option to that kind of love, which dominates, I think, the translation of love in our churches today? Maybe. I'm sure there ought to be. Maybe there are some options. Reinhold Niebuhr again talks about love as the working out of justice in society. Very simple definition. Maybe love is possible, which offers not service but solidarity, support, mutuality. Maybe we need to look very carefully at ways of removing the conditions from love. Maybe, in fact, and here I really am out of my depth and into theological waters where I'm not that at home, maybe our cherished version of Jesus the servant, the suffering servant, needs some revision. Maybe an option is something like the old Sunday school hymn, "What a friend we have in Jesus." Friends don't dominate, don't need clients, don't create dependency. Must in fact operate on fairly egalitarian terms. But good grief, this can be painful. When this begins to happen, the recipients of my caring and service are no longer grateful. They throw it back in my face. They think I'm not the answer to their needs. They invite me to be vulnerable. They kick me around. They risk exposing my addictions to helping. And finally, in a society that values usefulness, even in the context when most of us are useless in terms of what we do for the replication of society, One nice thing about friendship is that it is totally and utterly useless. And to be useless in our kind of society is to be something very close to subversive. What a totally unconditional and useless and subversive friend we have in Jesus. And what a challenge he raises for the servant church. Let me stop there and we can talk about some of this stuff. Comments, reactions, whatever. Challenges, I hope.
Somebody should explain that last statement, the uselessness of a friend.
Anybody else on my wavelength on that?
That's a mature, well-developed, healthy friendship. There are other kinds of friendships which are just like the dependency kind of thing we're talking about in other areas. But a really mature friendship where both are relatively healthy can be what you say.
I guess what I'm saying is that one notion of friendship as juxtaposed to a notion of service is that it assumes that the interaction of people who are seen as ends in themselves rather than of people who are seen as means to satisfy some need that I have, whether the need is to serve or something else. To use people might be to serve them, or it might be to consume their services. In either case, people we come into contact with in those kinds of relationships are very useful. I'm not sure that that's friendship in the way that I want to talk about it here. There's something when two people who are viewed as unconditionally human interact that doesn't produce anything.
Doesn't produce any noticeable effect or product.
And it's valued for itself. It's not valued for the fix I get from it. Yeah?
But in today's society, there's no economical exchange. There's no gain, economics.
Economic or psychological. Economic.
Yeah.
I think that's a very tricky thing because it sounds as though it's a limitation on the relationship, but I'm hearing that it's an expanded rather than a contracted view. It's as though for something to be useful, it has to meet certain definitions, certain criteria of what constitutes using. Mm-hmm. And to say it's useless is to free it from that limitation.
That's right. Service relationships are conditional and limited to the service and needs that interact.
I think
friendship is something wider.
What I would want to say is that I would hate to have my friendships be subject to my own or anyone else's definition of what constitutes usefulness. I'm thinking of a person who, whenever I had contact with him, was always trying to be a counselor to me. Mm-hmm. You know, he was always asking me, how is this going? What's happening over here? You know, trying to be a counselor to me.
Yes.
And without, not trying to say whether he would be or is a good counselor or not, I wasn't interested in that. I wasn't looking for a counselor. Necessarily, although sometimes friends I found are very good counselors, mm-hmm. Because they've maybe taken time to know who I am. Mm-hmm. When they give counsel, it's worthy of being listened to.
Mm-hmm. Well,
let me try to, I'm not sure that I'm following everything you're saying.
I like to play bridge. I have some friends in Columbus with whom I play bridge. I need them. I can't play bridge alone. It's a bore to look at all four hands and figure out how you would play them. So, am I dependent on them? Is this not a friendship? Or suppose that that I enjoy playing string quartets. I can't play them alone. I have to have three other people, a violin, a viola, and a cello, to do it. I'm dependent on them. Is that, how does that fall within your purview of friendship? And I like the people that I happen to play quartets mm-hmm. with. We enjoy each other's company in a lot of ways besides string quartets, but that is what brings us together.
Sure.
And we can't do it alone.
That's interdependence.
That's interdependent?
Of course. There is a dependent on you as you are on them.
Right. Both of your models of string quartet and bridge think exact underscore exactly what Jody's getting at, namely a complete mutual dependence. The model I think that he's troubled about is if you were to become a professional bridge player and you were the kind of counselor to four people in the neighborhood who could never get together and play by themselves unless you were there for them to turn to and say, did I do the right thing? And you became available for a small fee, and they simply could never play bridge together unless Walt was home and willing to come over and tell them what opening leads to make and pat them on the head when they led the right card. With you sitting among them and they needing you as much as you need them, that seems to me what Jody's after is the paradigm of friendship.
And the fee. In your other paradigm where Walt is needed to make sure that that other bridge game happens may not be monetary.
Right, right.
Clearly Walt might really need
right.
to be there and make sure these people know how to play bridge right.
Exactly.
So, yes, Doris. But you're using the word need then in a different... You're using the word need in a different sense, even though I need three other bridge players or three other string players. It's not the same thing as my needing to...
The client relationship in a service society is always hierarchical. Often the hierarchy is a concealed one. That is, we're not clear that our helping someone puts us in charge of them.
Okay.
All right? The examples you're giving are basically not hierarchical situations. The string quartet is a cooperative, egalitarian, communal working.
Peer relationship.
Yes.
All right, then what is the difference between what you're saying and Ayn Rand's philosophy? And why should we not stock Atlas Shrugged in the bookstore?
Say some more. I'm not an Ayn Rand either devotee, or neither do I know much about it.
Okay, well, Ayn Rand's notion, at least as I've read it, is that... the social state, the socialist state, the modern welfare state, really is human destroying, and that all of the liberal legislation of the last 50 years as having the effect of destroying people's independence, humanity, capacity for self-help. So it has to be dismantled root and branch, and we've got to replace it once again with people whose only motto is I look out for myself, that's all I look out for, and I'm doing you the best favor I can by absolutely ignoring your pleas for my assistance. Get out and do it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Sink or swim.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not misrepresenting it. It's a philosophy of total selfishness, which is the best way to help everybody else.
Yeah.
She writes ideological novels, basically, with long, long speeches advocating this kind of thing. And of course, exposing in caricature fashion welfare agencies and social liberal social legislation.
Mm-hmm. I think that probably the emphasis that the right wing, the libertarian part of the white right wing, which I gather Rand is part of, places on on individual capacity and the debilitating effects of the welfare state on capacity is an important thing to take note of. And it seems to me that I would, and I constantly get into arguments with my friends on the left, although not as much these days as I used to, about our inability on the left to incorporate notions about how you build people's capacity and how state intervention in lots of ways, the welfare state in particularly, operationally can debilitate and make dependence out of people. It seems to me clearly, you know, obviously what Rand leaves out is the in her equation, in her constant harping on human capacity, the individual capacity is a concern for justice. And it seems to me that in trying to figure our way into the next 50 years, that somehow these two things have to be balanced. Justice is not the provision of services that creates dependency in clients. Simply not. Neither does justice have anything to do with a do-your-own-thing, Adam Smith kind of free market notion. Clearly, in our kind of a world, that can't work either. But whatever we do, I'm saying, needs to take both of those poles into some kind of consideration. Doris.
Your point sort of reminds me of the martyr mother who keeps serving her child all the time without, just for the ego trip. And then when the child starts off to preschool and the child doesn't cry because mother leaves, she feels that she's been a failure now because the parting wasn't as sorrowful as the mother had hoped. Because the child is exerting some independence.
Sure.
But her prime object is an ego trip, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but maybe then she needs somebody to help her to be strengthened in herself so she can let that kid go. In other words, she needs an expert, someone who understands the way we operate emotionally. Maybe she has to go to a psychiatrist is what I'm saying. Maybe she is a client. Rightly so at that point. She needs to go and buy a service which will give her more insight, and then she can do less of this. You know, there are times when we need experts.
She might read a good book.
Yes.
Yes.
She needs to understand a good book.
Yes. Dave.
Isn't there another option that's fairly obvious, but on the other hand, I don't think anybody really trusts it. I suppose the whole business of Grary's understanding of the poor as having, inherent qualities of knowing. Well, let's put it even wider. Let's say anybody who is in need has an understanding better of what is going to solve their need than anyone else. And when you get into a position where, as you were suggesting earlier, where you just know that you can fill those needs better than anybody around, whether it be by your superior economic status or your knowledge or whatever, it seems to me that takes away a lot of trust about where people are and their coping capacity, and maybe we middle-class people are so flabby that we really don't trust ourselves, so we certainly, don't trust anybody else. But I don't think that's quite a friendship exchange either. It's perhaps a trusting kind of thing. And I don't know.
This whole business of the creation of false needs, no matter what level of the society you're talking about, I think is immensely complicated to begin to unravel. It is so easy for those of us in the middle class to be judgmental about the poor in cities who buy lots of things on credit and have a color TV in their living room, and then worry about where the meals when the welfare check runs out are coming from at the end of the month. I'm not sure that our ease in being judgmental about that it ought to be any different from our ease in being judgmental about the way we define our own needs and other people's needs, that we at least, you know, if we're going to let each other define needs in silly ways, we certainly ought to let everybody do that. It's very difficult. Development people in the third world who walk into it. I talked to a guy a couple months ago who had been in a poor Indian village in Mexico and was astounded to see, the ubiquitousness of fairly expensive portable radios in a town that had no sewage and thatched huts and so on. You might as well have been on the south side of Chicago. People were walking around with radios up in their ears. Well, you know, those kinds of needs are generated out of the kind of society we live in. And how really do we judge them?
Some of that gets to be, you know, imposed in subtle ways, you know, by our own thought that maybe they really do need radios more than sewage disposal plants or sewage.
Well, I can't help but be a little turned off when I follow someone in a grocery store that pays with food stamps and walks out and climbs into a brand new big car that still has the stickers on it from where they just bought it. That leaves me cold.
I'm not sure that we have got a good definition of needs. It sounds like we're talking about wants a lot here, too. And we've just managed to, and I realize that, you know, we're doing it ourselves, but it sounds like we're taking wants and translating them and saying, aha, needs. It's not only a service kind of phenomenon, but also something that occurs with goods, that somehow you do need an instrument that will cut tomatoes just in a certain way, and you can't use it for anything else but for cutting tomatoes in a certain way, just in the way you need it.
Well, you know, I mean, what our culture is wonderful at doing is to translate wants into needs, isn't it? It may be harder to see in the area of services, but I'm not sure that it's not more significant than in the area of goods. If you think about doing the normal functions of living, there is really no significant moment in our lives when we do not turn to experts outside of ourselves to define how it is we do that thing. We are birthed by doctors. Health is translated into medicine. They are not identical. Spiritual health is translated into church membership. They are not identical. Salvation is translated into that. They are not identical. Education is translated into schooling. Clearly, that is not an identity. Mental well-being is translated into having access to psychiatrists. That's not an identity. I'm not sure that you know, in one sense, we have retained any capacity for not only citizenship, but even minimal human self-sufficiency in this kind of a society. And that raises a real problem if you're interested in change, even if you're interested in being human. Yes?
Okay, what would you say to, I think, one of the first things, say, an inner city church does to help poor people is set up clothes closets or food shelves or even coalitions of inner city churches that often get folks that just move around, you know. Can that possibly be genuine? Or what would be a practical alternative to that?
Let me just say that the only model of professional service that interests me is a model kind of based on what Saul Alinsky used to say about community organizers, that nobody should go into a community who plans to stay there for more than 2 years, that the whole job of organizing a community is to organize yourself out of a job. and that when that community gets the capacity to act powerfully on its own, you move on, and you're no longer needed. I'm not sure if that's not an interesting model for all professional service providers, that when you set up clothes pantries, the total goal of that, along with the provision of the clothes to the people who need it, but the ultimate goal is to work yourself as professional clothes provider out of a job.
Well, isn't that the objective of missionaries in foreign countries?
Working themselves out of a job?
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that the objective?
Yes. Well, it certainly has not been the objective in any way, shape, or form.
Well, they try to make those people independent, and that's what I've seen in Africa, at least.
Well, there's been very little of that done, Doris. But some of the real clear-thinking people have done that. And when I talk in terms of short-term ministry, for example, in Latin America, being able to do what needs to be done and move on so that then they do it their own way, the Division for World Missions of the American Lutheran Church talks to me about thinking in terms of lifetime service there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, my knowledge is very limited. I've visited Arusha where they have just turned it all over to the natives, and I thought, what an excellent job. I just sort of assumed that was a general pattern of missionaries everywhere. It is with the Peace Corps, I know, when they go in, they try to teach the natives the skills that they need and then move on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I work with Partners in Mission, which is a fairly new mission, a way of doing missions. But the object that they are trying to put across, the philosophy is to work with the people to bring about justice and try to make a project self-supporting as soon as possible.
Yeah, they're at the leading edge.
Pardon?
Partners in Mission is at the leading edge of what's going on in missionary activity today. I think they've got the right idea.
What do you do, though, if you can't do that?
Why can't you do that? You know,
I don't know.
That's my question. You see, I'm on a mission field where we've done it for 40 years, and they've always said, well, we can't cut them off now. and if that could go on ad infinitum, you know, that's... We can't do it because I think Jody put his finger right on it from the beginning. We don't want to do it. We want them to be dependent on us. We may not verbalize that, but it's inside of us.
When I saw your films the other night, I thought that's what you were doing.
Maybe at the same time they don't want to be independent.
Absolutely, you bet they don't. It's much nicer for them to have a high-paid outsider come in and do the job instead of them.
Which is precisely, I suppose, what the
translates down
does.
To parish level Christianity in the United States, too.
Yeah.
Which gets so complex. You know, the Tanzanian church maybe is a good example. Where its leadership is behind an awful lot of its people, and so we just get it all confused, and it never kind of comes clean. And,
yeah.
But the other thing, to go back to this Iran thing, it seems to me that we've also got to recognize that there are cultures that are far, far older than ours, and who do not exist with a competitive value system as being the supreme goal in everything, and the I think it's fair to say that Ayn Rand ran those nonsense to a lot of cooperative value systems, so that that there is an integrity, there is a strength in some cultures that we know nothing about, and unless we can trust that some way, as one World Council mission person put it, probably the ALC is 30 years behind any other church in America at that point. And that includes whatever you want to include.
I think that's a fair thing.
I wonder if it's possible, though, to say, I hear us all the time repudiating our history and saying, oh, it's terrible. No, we bemoan what we've done, we repudiate and reject. And in a sense, we curse ourselves on so many fronts. I wonder if it's possible that our history can be redeemed rather than rejected. I read Atlas Shrugged. I don't know that I, you know, can remember it adequately, or, and I don't think it's a complete picture, but I was intrigued by it and somewhat encouraged by someone thinking that my history has something to be said for it. Full of holes as it is, wrong-headed and messed up, but something, you know, there's a, it's possible instead of going backwards to go ahead, you know, to, instead of saying I've got to go back, sometimes maybe I do have to go back. I experienced that too. But, you know, there is a hidden corporateness in the idea that what serves me serves you. There is a hidden, I think, corporateness in that. We do share, we're fellow sovereigns, you know. Carol used to say we're kings and queens under the King of Kings and Queens. That means we're fellow sovereigns. And in a sense, what serves my sovereignty also serves yours, and what serves your sovereignty serves mine. We're not, you know, it's like what Vern was doing in the first session here about saying, you know, we're no longer idolizing Jesus as the final answer, but he is the final answer because he makes us the final answer. He says, okay, now each one of you take the ball and go with it. And our sovereignty collides, but still, it's all right.
But he never sends us out individually or corporately without the realization that there is somewhere along the line a need for confession of sins. It seems to me that it's true that a church body, let's say, sociologically, is incapable of doing that. I remember getting in on a discussion where the ALC was just beginning and they were writing this theological basis for it. What the heck was it? I've forgotten his name, gratefully. Anyway, I, as a young pastor, was trying to stand up and say a few things about, you know, shouldn't we really begin as a new church body by confessing our sins? You know, what's wrong with that? Why, you know, why are we so constitutionally unable to do that? Well, Martin Marty happened to be there for some lectures, and every so often he'd chuckle to himself quite a bit whenever I did this. And he'd go over by me, and he'd kind of smile, and he'd squeeze my shoulder and say, "Keep it up, Dave, that's great." You know, but he knew how futile that was. And I guess, you know, I'd have to say that in my lifetime, I don't think I've really seen a statement by the church, by maybe any church body, certainly not my own, that has ever begun with a confession of sins. Maybe the manifesto for the third, you know, it comes close, but other than that, you know, where do we ever see a realization that we live dependently day by day on that whole thing individually? But, well, Douglas John Hall has been saying a few things about our incapacity as a church. You don't expect it from a corporation. They've got a PR department that prevents it. We don't have that. You know, why can't we still do it? Why can't we lay out what we, you know, all the dirty linen we want to, knowing that our Lord takes care of that? But we aren't capable of doing that.
The promise, I think the promise of the Lord is precisely that my dirty linen is not the issue, and neither is yours in our relationship in Christ. It's there, and you better not deny it, but it's just the opening statement. It ought to be the opening statement, probably, but it isn't the final statement.
But when it's never a statement, then I worry.
Well, that's still just part of it, though.
Some of the things I've been hearing over here is that make me think about part of the philosophy of partners in mission. We're so used to being givers that we don't know how to receive anymore. And we need to realize that people in other cultures and other countries also have something to give to us. Communication has opened up the world to us in many ways, radio, television, so on and so forth. And we're used to looking down on some of these people who have cultures and gifts and things to offer us. Maybe not financially or material gifts, but other gifts. And this is part of the concept of partnership. And so that when we can bring justice to them, and probably we have to serve them in the mission field for a while, but if we can bring justice and make their lives better, then then we are also receiving.
I think right along with that is even so far as the statement that you made earlier there about getting turned off, seeing somebody buy food with food stamps and having a brand new car, that may be absurd to us, but some of our own values may be even more absurd to them, and perhaps that kind of a situation can help us look at our own. Where we are living at $100,000 homes, and we could get by with considerably less, and our wealth could be used to much better advantage, except to our own. But that's pretty absurd when you think about it. What we have and others don't have, and we're not willing to share. That's sin. It's really bad.
Well, I think I was hearing you saying that there's something wrong with expertise. Am I hearing you say that to start with?
I think that there's some problems with experts. Which is different from what you just said.
You're not trying to do away with experts.
No, some people who think along these lines go in Ayn Rand's direction, but others go into a sort of primitivist business, which says we can forget the kind of advanced setting in which we live, and that it's 1980, and that clearly complex systems need to be understood, and anything but that.
Right. You're not saying we all ought to become self-contained economic and personal units.
I just want to make sure that those of us who value expertise know the dangers that go with it, which in this kind of a society, I think, involves largely a creation of dependency.
All right. Our family doctor says that his goal for us is no medications, no visits to the hospital, and he doesn't like to see us in his office, unless it's for a semi-annual physical checkup or something like that. He's an Episcopalian layman who volunteers his services in a inner city hospital in the emergency room, and who tells his fellow parishioners that his greatest disappointment in medicine is the number of people who want to be sick when they aren't, and curable or solvable medical problems like venereal disease. How would you translate that then into a clergy role? Is the role of a clergy person to make theologians out of all of the parishioners in some sense, or help them to be articulate about their theology? Would that be a proper use of theological expertise? I like our family doctor because I think he practices the kind of medicine I want to be practiced on.
Sure. Just on that first thing, there's a famous Life magazine thing 10 years ago that surveyed doctors across the country in family practice, and the doctor said that over 70% of the people who visited their offices had nothing wrong with them, nothing physically wrong with them.
Yeah.
But they treated them anyway. That was the next thing. Because they came to the doctor, they were treated. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a clergyman. I haven't thought that through. The roles of pastor, priest, and prophet are difficult ones to work out without the creation of dependency, I think. The stuff we've heard this week about what's lacking in the parish in terms of a feeling of fellowship, of belonging, of community, of somehow, you know, one way to translate that is that they feel incredibly and dehumanizedly dependent when they go to the parish, you know, and somehow that they are not treated as ends in themselves, that as means for the glorification of something that is beyond themselves. in this case being the pastor's ego, maybe. I don't know, Paul.
The other side of the coin of that somewhat is, though, that, my husband is a pastor, and I talk with other pastors and stuff, and one of their biggest frustrations sometimes is trying to make people independent, offering seminars and so on, say, for example, on evangelism, and then going through, here's some steps and here's some tools for you, and the people turn right around and they don't want to go out and do it. They something happens or so-and-so down the street isn't a believer, pastor, you call on them. A lot of times, it's not always just the pastor's fault that people become dependent. A lot of times, it's one of the hardest jobs a pastor has is to try to push these people out and get them to be independent. And boy, they fight it all the way. They'll come in, opening meeting with you and we'll call you to our parish now. And boy, we'd like you to help us, be independent. And we want to do the evangelizing. We want to do the hospital calling and so on. You get there. Pastor, you go call them in the hospital. Pastor, you evangelize them. I mean, so it is a two-way thing.
Sure. That's the point about the creation of needs. Needs are real. And we need to have somebody up on that pedestal doing all this stuff for us as a professional clergy person.
There's a sense in which I think the... I grew up in a... My father was a minister. And I lived in a minister's household for a number of years. And was aware of my father's absence all the time. And one of the reasons he was absent was that in this congregation, it had gotten to the point where some group couldn't meet to decide what color choir robes they should buy, unless my father was there. Oh, well, Pastor, what do you think? I mean, we get blue or maroon. Now, the point is that what my father should have done, I think, looking back on it, was instead of going to the meeting and giving a 10-minute talk on how the group should be independent and decide the issue of choir robes on their own, was to say that he couldn't make it to the meeting. That's what he couldn't quite do, though. I mean, he couldn't quite... It was one thing for him to go and give a speech as the pastor on, now I think we ought to have a little more independence. It was another thing for him to say, I can't make the meeting. I've got to be with my family tonight. And they would have immediately said, oh, well, then, Pastor, I think we'll have to move it till next Tuesday then. Oh, no, you hold the meeting this evening. And, I'll be very interested in seeing what you decide, but I'm going off to, whatever. And that's one thing he didn't do often enough.
Or maybe just telling them, really, you five people can just as well decide the color as I can. For one thing, I'm colorblind. Nice cop, Arthur.
What pastors need are experts to help them train.
Tell Al belongs to the Missouri City.
I wonder if Jesus' model, I think we have to be real careful how we use it and all this and that. But his model is a real good one. He spent 3 years with those guys and a few other people. And then he disappeared into the clouds, and they were all standing there gaping into the sky.
You can.
In a way, I think you can do that because, although I think if you do it, you get into a lot of trouble with your parishioners. But I think in the long run, it's much better for the parishioners.
You're in trouble.
And I think it's still the pastor.
And every time they ask him a question and turn to his expertise, he gave some incredibly complicated and totally ridiculous answer, right?
Yes.
I think a great deal of what's being said is true, but I wonder at the same time if we're denying something that, unless Paul was, institutionalized right away, some were pastors, some were teachers,
that's
some were
right.
missionaries, all this kind of thing. And not everyone in the parish can be a pastor and call on people in the hospitals. I'm just...
Yeah.
They go crazy trying to do it. They don't know what to say. Maybe they need training. But on the other hand, maybe they just, that's not in them to do it.
I wonder, I would like to, I would hope for a conception of pastoring pastoring that would say that there might be a pastor who simply is no good at calling on people in hospitals, so somebody else in this parish is going to have to do that.
Or
it's going to be done the way it ought to be done.
Or somebody who sings to lead the liturgy. That's.
Yeah.
I think Pastor
Bowen was talking about preventive medicine. A doctor who keeps you well, and when you're in trouble, you can go there. I think there should be preventive religion. If you're well and healthy in your faith, you run into trouble, maybe then your services are needed.
I think that a kind of rule of thumb is to have your aim, Joey put it differently earlier, to become superfluous as quickly as possible. Yeah. I mean, one test that you can use on yourself is to see exactly how many times people turn to you for the alleged, quote, service that you're providing. I mean, if they continue to turn very long, then there's something wrong with the way the service is being administered. There's some way that you've made, it's more important for you to be needed by them than it is for you to free themselves to do this on their own. And I think as clients, and we all find ourselves in client positions as sometimes, perhaps as often as we do in the other position, is to, the more we find the relationship we have with the person who's helping us becoming a dependency, the more we become hooked on that person, the more our trust in ourselves is becoming eroded, and we better either modify or cut that relationship off. Those, are, I think, are kind of good rules of thumb to kind of use to break through this.
Yes, Doris.
Well, once a year, we always fill out a form where our talents are, and then the pastor can draw on these for help. So if you put in that you would like to do evangelism, you're not going to say no when the pastor comes and asks you. But yet you see that whole list of things that needs to be done in the congregation and pick the one that you feel you can do.
Yeah, the whole point is that the pastor doesn't have to come and ask you, though. Mm-hmm. The Board of Education, the Board of Evangelism.
Whoever is in charge of that, the Evangelism Committee, if you check evangelism as your talent, why, then the Evangelism Committee asks you to help them.
We are nearing final word time. Dave, it's yours.
Penultimate word, please. But one little distinction here, it seems to me, we've been talking a lot about skills, like, say, in the congregational life. And if I heard Walt a little earlier in the comment here about preventive sin, maybe we ought to really be in the business of really in theology and, forget about the skills. That they can be found if we will be willing to look at them. But how serious are we getting? It really came home to me. We had a review of a day school that we have, and a little Catholic nun, about 33 years old, came up with a scorious criticism of the pastors in the parish who were, going over teaching religion. They were doing this and that. They were leading some worship. All this kind of thing. She said, the only thing you know anything about, you're lousy teachers. And we all kind of had to hang our heads and say yes. But she said, the one thing you've got is supposedly some theology. Maybe you could work with the teachers at that point. And it seems to me that we're doing very little, really, in adult education on serious theological study. And I'm not saying that that's the answer to everything, but it's certainly more to the core than skill training or, that kind of business. And if we could get serious about that and make people confident about their theological understanding of the scriptures, then I think we might be in the business of preventive sin and...
Well, the experts in the kitchen are providing service for us at noon. Would you get up? Thank you all.